Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. We have something really different today because we don't usually go to Israel, do we, Chris?
Yeah, Israel is one of those countries we don't seem to cover that much of on History Hack. It's sort of almost a blind spot.
Yeah, because Gally left. Gally moved to Berlin and we didn't have anyone in Israel to tell us about history in this region. So who have we got with us today?
So today we have got, and I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciations, but we have got Eyal Halfon, who is an Israeli screenwriter and historian, and Ran Bakai, who is a professor of prehistoric history at the University of Tel Aviv. So welcome to History Hack.
Hello. We are very pleased to be here.
How is his pronunciation?
It's okay. I'm Eyal, and I'm a screenwriter, full stop, and a filmmaker, nothing to do with history.
Okay, cool. Right, okay. So we have to talk about your new book, which is coming out in English. It's been a big hit in Hebrew, and it's called They Were Here Before Us. It's absolutely brilliant, guys. I really enjoyed reading it. And I think a lot of that is to do with the way it's written and the way you've approached it. So can you tell us a bit about your approach and how you chose to structure it? Because I think this is what's made it so approachable, because it's very much not just a trek around different archaeological sites, is it?
So I'm the one to be blamed for the approach. I'm a storyteller by my profession, by my nature. This is what I do. I'm a screenwriter and I happened to bump into prehistory and to Ran, and I became his student. And then just before he convinced me to do my PhD in archaeology, I told him, before anything else, we should write a book because there's too many great stories here that nobody knows about him. And so the approach started from my natural love to stories. And the fundamental step, first step that we made was that we will do this book as a journey through time and journey through places. And we will use the Levant, or where we live, Israel, Palestine, this whatever it was called hundreds of thousands of years ago, if it had any name, we will use it as like a canvas for a map for our journey. And then, so this was the first step, and a journey, a storytelling. And as we started working on it, we had 10 stops along the way.
I really think it does. So, I mean, Ran, let's start with how far back we can go, because this book covers a million years of history, doesn't it? Why does this involve a slightly strange old man and his theoretical tomatoes? And what do the landmark excavations, is it Obadiah? Tell us about our ancestors and how they lived.
Well, it's a like all good stories, it's a strange story. So we start actually from the beginning. And a million years is just a rough phrasing, because we start a little bit earlier than 1 million. We don't know how early, but much closer than 1.5 million, but we don't know for sure. And we started from the first time that we can say that early men stepped on the piece of land where we live. And this was discovered accidentally by mistake by a farmer who was looking for a place to grow tomatoes or zucchini or whatever. And he stumbled onto this very strange place in the Jordan Valley where he wanted to grow some vegetables, but he found huge animal bones and large stone tools that he realized are really fascinating. And he actually stumbled upon one of the earliest sites, human sites, archaeological sites outside of Africa. And this is the site of Ubedia, which is one of the first stops that early men visited while departing from Africa and roaming around the world. So this is the first stop. He's a very interesting guy, the guy who found the site. So it's a combination of a nice story of early men, tomatoes or zucchini, and a very nice guy that really found a marvelous discovery.
I just, if I can, well, I heard about this guy. His name is Izzy Marimsky. As a student, I heard about him in one of the classes that Ran gave. Neither me or even Ran knew that he's still alive. This was our first trip. And when we began writing the book, we said, let's go to this kibbutz in the Jordan Valley, because somebody said that this guy is still there. And we met him, and it was a big surprise for me and even for Ran that we met this guy. And he's an incredible guy. He's nearly 19 years old, but the only thing that he was injured when we met him from a hang gliding accident. So
that's brilliant.
Right.
Yeah, we actually discovered, I was going to say that we discovered that the people that discover the sites are not less interesting than the sites themselves. So the combination of the human factor is really fascinating, because all these people are really extraordinary, either archaeologists or amateur archaeologists. They are really a very special kind of people. So we met this guy that I never met before, and he made one of the greatest discoveries in the archaeology of the world. And he's still very humble. He lives in the same place. He doesn't take credit for that, but he's excited at the age of 90, as he was when he discovered the site. So it was really fascinating.
That's amazing.
And he still holds some of the tools and animal bones near the pictures of his grandchildren and grand-grandchildren. And it blends together beautifully.
So what makes the site, apart from the size and the scale of it, what makes the site so special? What else is in there?
Well, what makes it special is that it is a prehistoric paradise. It is an example of the landscape, of the animals, of the plants that early humans enjoyed when they came to visit the Jordan Valley for the first time. And this is a very nice demonstration why the Jordan Valley was not left since then. It's a great place. It's a great place to live along the lakeshore. 1 million years ago, life was a big picnic. They had an endless picnic. They were having a marvelous time there. And it's a wonderful demonstration about how life looked like 1 million years ago. And this is one of the rarest examples existing in the world of how life looked 1 million years ago.
It's amazing. Just for record, Jordan is possibly one of my favorite countries on the planet. I do trips there every year. But I also love elephants. We're talking about large animal bones. And there's animals up there, isn't there, that you wouldn't expect to find. So I own an elephant. Well, not own, but she's mine because I've looked after enough to claim her. And I'm stuck with her. She's moody and she's old and cantankerous. But you need to tell me why it was okay for these people to eat elephants. Tell us about Ahmed and try and settle my mind as to why 750,000 years ago in the Levant, people were eating elephants. And how do we know this?
I have to warn you that. Yep. If you will start the topic of elephants with Ran, you will need at least two or three special podcasts, because this was when I met Ran as a student, and even till today, he is the elephant man of the Tel Aviv University. So now he has something else in his mind. He probably will tell you later, but so he will tell you anything about elephants and their importance in human life and diet. But Ahmed, because you mentioned the name of Ahmed, Ahmed was he was the king. He was I heard about Ahmed. It's an elephant from Kenya, nicknamed the King, and a friend of mine who is one of the most important or smart Israelis sport journalist and a big fan of elephant in Africa. He told me about Ahmed. And we brought the story of Ahmed as a contradiction to the state of elephants nowadays in Africa, that they are in a very bad situation and they are declining. And it's a part in the, you know, in the book, you probably know that this is another step that we made in our approach. We tried to make every chapter to find something that is significant for our life today. So when we will talk about fire, we discuss what happens with fire nowadays and how it jeopardizes our life. And with elephants and the importance of elephant in human evolution and dietary, Ran will tell you about it, we try to move to nowadays and see and portray what's the role of elephants, indigenous people in Africa, and is it the same or could it be the same as it was before? And now I leave all the topic of all the elephant goes to Ran.
So we're going over to the elephant man, aren't we, Ran? This is now your nickname on the internet. It's all about calories, isn't it? We're constantly trying to limit our calories nowadays, but complete opposite for our ancestors.
Absolutely, absolutely. They needed every piece of calorie they could get. They weren't sitting in front of the screen all day. They were roaming around and losing calories. So they had to make up for that. And elephants, I mean, everybody likes elephants. They liked elephants as well. But for them, elephants were not only habitat companions, but also the perfect calories package. So they were dependent on elephants for the survival, elephants and other animals, and they paid elephant respect in a way that we don't do. It's a strange combination of dependency and respect, which followed human history for over 1 million years or even more than 1 million years. And we realized that, like many indigenous societies that live now, humans were highly dependent on elephants for many, many reasons. And we suggested that the human legacy is intertwined with elephants for a very, very long time. So we tried to connect it, as Eyal said, to the very miserable situation in which elephants are now. And we tried to convey the message that elephants should get the respect they deserve, because for much of human history, elephants made us human and allowed us to live. So we should keep them with us and not eliminate them from the planet.
Yeah, I'm all about loving the elephants.
Amazing. Yeah. So we believe that this likeness of elephants goes way back to the human past, when humans shared habitats with elephants, appreciated elephants, and understood that their life is dependent upon elephants. We believe, at least I believe, that while elephants were still roaming the earth, everything was okay and everything was relaxed and humans enjoyed plenty. Once elephants were not around, things began to change. And this is a cycle that we're all stuck in still today. So we should appreciate the elephants, not only because they are so nice, but mostly because they had a major role in the prosperity of our species.
I just want to add to the elephant, because you mentioned it. So and you talk about the fat and the importance of fat, and we discussed in length in the book the importance of fat, and there is a chapter called "The Man, the Fat Hunters," and it's related, and this is where the elephants are. But also in nowadays, even in my family, while I remember after when my kids, they learned that fat is a good thing. So when we go to the butcher, we do not ask for the lame part of the meat. We ask for fats with a meat with a big portion of fat. And they learned that it's not too bad to eat fat. And they survive. They are very good and healthy kids.
I must admit, I was not successful in this regard. Maybe because Eyal has boys and I have girls. But my daughters were not convinced by my academic arguments. And they tell me, please do not bring work home. And let us go without the fat. So
I have that problem between my daughter and my sons as well. My my daughter's like, can we have the leaner bit? And my son's like, ooh, fat. So, but this feels a bit like a surreal question, but what do the Flintstones have to do with the narrative?
Well, the Flintstones. well, you have to, even I'm not old enough to remember the Flintstones. Well, the Flintstones, they were... The first animated television program for adults, not Mickey Mouse. Mm-hmm. They were in the 60s. Big success. They were ahead of their time. I mean, they were the Simpsons of today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Flint is, of course, crucial and fundamental in the life of early humans. And when we we were looking for material to write about Flint, we said, hey, what about the Flintstones? How come the Americans made first this animation all about family that lives around Flint and smokes cigars? So we use the Flint family as an anchor to go into the importance and of Flint in our life. And because I'm from the film business and television business, it was great fun for me to learn more about the Flintstones.
And the Flintstones is just a great expression. I mean, it is catchy and it is true. The life of early humans were all about stone, all about flint. I mean, there was no metal, no plastic, no nothing. They had to do everything with flint, with stone. So Flintstones is just the right name for them. And not only that, but by studying them, we came to realize that they treated not only the material, they treated stone like they treated elephant with respect. They treated everything that they were dependent upon with respect. So stone was not only a resource. Stone was embedded in their life. They respected stone. They treated stone like a very wise material. They realized that stone is much, much older than them. And stone was a major part of the world, but not only in practical terms, only in even in conceptual terms. So we realized that they loved stone, they appreciate stone, they respect stone, and they saw in stone so many qualities that we do not see today. So this is really, really, really admirable. And we went, Eyal and myself, we went to see places where early humans quarried stone. And this is places full with energy. I mean, you can not be there and not feel the very strong energy of the earth where they quarried stone from the bottom of the ground, point out to make tools. These places are really places of very strong energy, very strong feeling. Beautiful landscapes, it is really telling.
So as I said, so the Flintstones, like other parts in the book, helps us to portray the way early humans were. The concept that we have about early humans is in popular art is very strange. And Flintstones is one example. They made some very interesting approaches there. So this is another reason why it was good for us to use in a book that tells the story about 1 million years ago, something from the 60s of the last century.
Yeah, I think I always loved the car, the fact that they still had to run in the car to get it to move. That made me laugh. and I always wondered why Fred wasn't thinner if he did all that running. But you've already mentioned earlier on, AR, the fire. So I suppose it's one of the most crucial inventions or discoveries, isn't it? So in terms of your timeline and our million years of history in that, when did our prehistoric ancestors figure out fire, and how do we know this?
I can tell you, because I'm an outsider, I will tell you that definitely with when in prehistory arouse a big conflict between scholars, and it's big fun to watch it. And fire, and when fire is really one of the main debates, used to be hunting, but I don't think anymore. So the answer varies from hundreds of thousands to 40,000 years ago. And a correct answer, maybe Ron has one.
This is brilliant, because Chris and I are 20th century military historians. So we're like, what? Did no one write this down?
Well, first, one of the benefits of looking so deep into the past is the ability to break all kind of myths or all kind of concepts which are considered to be true. So looking at fire from the other way around, what is nice to demonstrate is that for most of human prehistory, humans were able to survive and thrive without fire. Fire for us looks like something which is mandatory, which we must have in order to make a living, and this is not the case. Humans lived and thrived for millions of years without fire. So this is possible. I mean, we are not standard for anything. We cannot do anything without fire, but they were able to. So the question is not when fire was discovered that we can be relieved and know that they had fire, but why fire was needed. And it seems first that for the first 2 million years, they didn't need fire for cooking. They most probably ate meat and fat raw without cooking. Fire has not only benefits, it has also disadvantages. You have to collect wood for fire. You inhale the smoke. There are many disadvantages. So there are big debates about the use of fire. And many of them start from the modern perspective that fire is only beneficial and needed. So the answer is, it is not. For most of the time, fire was not needed. Fire was needed from some point in time. And like any technology, it has benefits and it has downsides. So early humans had to calculate between the benefits and the downsides. And one of the benefits, like cooking, emerged only very late. We know that people started barbecuing only 400,000 years ago. For the first 2 million years, they didn't barbecue. They ate meat and fat raw without cooking. And this is possible. You can ask any Eskimo or Inuit. They still prefer meat and fat raw, and it is possible. And if we talk about fat, cooking makes the fat disappear. If you like fat, you better eat it uncooked. So there are big debates. If we get to the point, there is one site in Israel called Gesher Benot Yaakov, which is 800,000 years ago, and there are clear evidence for the use of fire. So fire was used at least 800,000 years ago. Fire became habitual, it appears at every site starting 400,000 years ago, not earlier than that. But for the last 400,000 years, humans are using fire on a daily basis. And
that's mad. It's like, I mean, I have an air fryer, and I joke that I can't live without my air fryer. I couldn't. And clearly I could. And it's interesting to think of it as in...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Definitely massively changed how people live, but it didn't necessarily... It wasn't like a huge leaping improvement in how they live.
I think what they do change is it's not the use of fire or the what you can do with fire. Is the maintaining of fire. By maintaining fire, by keeping fire going on, and not once in a while, it changes your perspective to the environment. You are starting to work around a campfire. You need to look after the fire. And I think that this made a difference in their life.
Yeah, but I think that from a very early age, they were capable of the production of fire at will. I think that they knew how to make fire. We studied them for a very long time, and we know that they were capable of many, many things, I think including making fire. But there's still no evidence for that. But again, fire became habitual, became present at every site. In my perspective, only 400,000 years ago, the 2 million years before that, fire was not at every site, at every cave, and people could make a living, like you say, without fire. For us, it seems impossible, but I guess that they were capable of making a living without fire. I guess that fire was used mostly for protection against animals, but not for other reasons that we find necessary.
But you can see now from the tone of our conversation, that this is something that is related to the book. So I convinced Ramno, in our book, we have more question marks than exclamation marks. Because yeah. I like to leave, I think, Ran the same. We are not sure about everything, and the definite is not, it's boring sometimes. So a question mark keeps you on the edge. You want to know more. Yeah.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sure.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the reasons that the book works so well, I think.
But this one's a bit personal as well, because being ginger, we get a lot of people making jokes about this as well. But Neanderthal can be used as an insult. How wrong is it, and why do we use it as an insult these days?
It's very wrong. It is as wrong as can be. There's no reason for that. This is just, it is outrageous. It is really wrong. And this is only because of historical circumstances. Because Neanderthals were the first humans which are not us to be discovered. So they were used throughout time as a counter ego to us. So
yeah.
At the beginning of research, people were trying to show how different they are from us in order to characterize us. Homo sapiens.
Yeah, I guess it's like we won. We survived. They
absolutely
didn't. They must have been done.
And that's another reason. They lost. They didn't survive. So people looked down for them. Now we know, for many years we know, that they survived in the harsh European climate for 400,000 years. And they were as capable as us, if you ask me. So this insult should be erased. I mean, it should be thought over, and there's no reason to treat us anything other like our brothers or our cousins, which maybe looked a bit different than us, but not much. And now we know that they were very, very similar to us rather than different.
And in this journey that I described, in our journey, we were very lucky to live or to travel land that hosted in one site both Neanderthals and Homo sapiens at the same time in this cave by cave or a few hundred meters one from the other. And this is the Mount Carmel caves that Dorothy Gerrard, the British archaeologist, digged and wrote about. Again, this is a place that more than one book could be written about, and at least we made it. It gave us one good stop on this journey, that an opportunity to discuss the enigma of the Neanderthal and what do we know about them? Why do we see them different than what they was, where they were? And what happened to them, which is still a question.
This isn't a question on our list, but like, what are the major differences? You said they look different to us.
A bit.
Yeah.
I think that I think we wrote that that if a Neanderthal would be dressed nowadays with a suit and proper shoes and if we will have a hat that we won't see his upper part of his skull, and he will walk among us in the street, we won't look at him differently. We won't see him differently than I will look at a Chinese or a South American guy that will come to my neighborhood. Do you agree, Ron?
Well,
maybe it will be stronger.
There were some differences. For example, they didn't have a chin. The chin is the most remarkable difference. They didn't have a chin. They had a larger nose than us, and they had larger eyebrows. The major differences are in the skull, and I should say it quietly, they had a larger brain than us. Their brain was larger. So you can push the differences both ways. They were humans as us with slight differences. As a group, they have their characteristics, which are a bit different than our group. But as Eyal said, we have intergroup differences as well. And some of us look a bit like Neanderthals, and some of them looked a bit like us. Now we know that there was gene exchange between Neanderthals and modern humans. So Homo sapiens and Neanderthals made love, made sex, exchanged genes, and made fruitful offsprings. So we are very similar.
Cool. So when I think of prehistoric history, I think of cave paintings. You do touch on those in your book. How have these contributed to our understanding of our ancestors?
That's a bias. That's a big bias. Another myth. Cave paintings are a very particular phenomenon that appears mostly in Western Europe and has nothing to do with the rest of the world. I mean, it is a very specific phenomenon that appears mostly in northern Spain and southern France. It is very specific geographically. It is very specific chronologically. And it sheds its shadow over everything. It is so amazing, it is so magnificent, that it became to be synonym to early humans. Well, early humans had the capability of doing that, for sure. They done that in a very specific, under very specific circumstances, in very specific places. So it's a nice demonstration of the potential capabilities of early humans, but it was not demonstrated everywhere, and it was wrongly used against Neanderthals. Neanderthals didn't make cave paintings, and for many years it was used in order to show the cognitive and technological differences between Homo sapiens, who was an artist, and Neanderthals, who were not. But we should keep in mind that 90% of Homo sapiens that lived on Earth weren't making cave art. So cave art is very particular. It is amazing, but it is most probably a result of very specific circumstances that took shape in Western Europe and showed the potential of being human but it has nothing to do with the rest of humanity, in my view.
It's like if you go to coffee places in Tel Aviv, probably London and LA the same. So my wife says everybody here writes script. Everybody, they are all filmmakers here. Well, it's true to those that everybody at least wants to be filmmakers in the coffee shops in Tel Aviv, but 95% of the people who live here do other things in their life. So at least from this perspective, early humans did survived and thrived and were very amazing people, even without cave art, that we have lots to say about what the meaning behind cave art, if it is art.
One more word about cave paintings. For sure, they give us a glimpse into the belief system of early humans, which is really rare. And it shows us that they were really connected to deep and dark caves. And they entered deep and dark caves in order to portray most probably their dreams on the walls of the cave, like the movie of Werner Herzog, which he called Caves of Forgotten Dreams. So these paintings give us a very rare window into their fears, their beliefs, their capabilities. So it is really interesting. And what is most interesting is that they were mainly painting animals. They were mainly painting large animals, which was the most important thing for them, in my opinion. So this connects to the elephants. There is one cave in the Dordogne where there is 130 depictions of mammoths, which were made in one stroke, which is amazing. So it connects their respect and dependency to the animals with their belief system, which is really, really nice.
Or does it present a dream of the best barbecue in the world ever?
in a way, but yeah. we think that it presents the barbecue that they were lacking. I mean, at that time they were experiencing the disappearance of large animals from Earth. It was during animal extinction. So we believe that they depicted what was missing from the barbecue menu, in a way.
Excellent.
Again, we didn't hesitate for a moment, and we took a plane and rented a car and went out of our way in the Levant and drove all the way to the Dordogne, including this specific cave that Ran just mentioned, and we had to see it. And it's part of our journey, a very delightful and tasty part of our journey.
Yeah, that definitely is a road trip to be proud of, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this is Chris's my favorite question. Why is one woman worth the life of 90 tortoises?
So, okay. To begin with, I think that every woman is deserve or entitled to this amount of tortoises and many more.
Correct answer.
Okay, so I thought that this would be the answer that you...
Yeah, this would be answer of a married man.
So this is my first answer. And this specific woman that you asked about was a very special woman. We were in the cave. We climbed to the cave where she was buried. And Ran will tell you why. What was so special about her. And what we believe she was.
Well, she was special indeed. She was buried in a very special place, in a cave again. And caves were really significant for early humans. The archaeologists that excavated this cave believed that this woman was a shaman. She was a shaman of a group. She was their contact persons with the other worlds, with the world on top and the world beyond and the underworld. And she was buried not only with 90 tortoises, she was buried with the wing of an eagle. She was buried with the pelvis of a panther. She was buried with all kinds of parts of animals that most probably assisted her in her journeys to the other world. Shamans are using animals and animals' qualities and powers in order to communicate with the cosmos. So we believe that this woman was a mediator of the group between the worlds in order to solve problems, to solve disasters, to provide answers, and so on. So the group was dependent on this handicapped small woman in order to give answers, to cure the land, to cure people. So they invest a lot in her. We believe that the tortoise, for example, are a primordial animal that might have assisted her in her journeys to the underworld. So we believe that this is a kind of a kit of precious animals that helped her during her life to perform her duty to the group. And this is why she was buried with them. They found another pit near her grave, which contained the bones of an ox, which weighed over 1 ton. So there was a feast during her burial of the group of an ox that weighed 1,000 kilos to pay her respect, to send her to her way. So this was a woman which was really important for the group. But again, it demonstrates the role of different animals in the lives of these early humans. They were highly connected to the cosmos. They were looking for answers in the world around them. And they had mediators. They had specific people in the group that did this kind of connection between them and the world. So she was really important, and every animal that was buried with her had its role within the duties of this shaman, of this very, very significant woman, we believe.
And the importance for us, the importance for us in her story is shamanism is a subject that at least the third part of the book, Focus and Altered State of Consciousness, is a topic that we discuss a lot in the last parts of the book. And when we thought about the places that we want to visit in the journey, we knew that shamanism should be there, and this woman was exactly there for us to elaborate the importance of shamanism in indigenous people and in early human life.
But even nowadays in Israel, there is a recent woman which calls herself Shaman of the Turtles, and she's sitting below this cave and practicing shamanism nowadays.
You can make an appointment through Facebook with her.
Absolutely.
That is amazing. And she's connected. The world is so screwed that she's like, right, wait, I'm going to try it. What's the worst
shamanism
that could happen?
Is alive and kicking in Israel.
It's not what I was going to say about all the animals. If they're so reverent of animals, and these aren't everyday animals, like the wings of an eagle and a 1-ton ox, like if that's what she's worth to them, then that's a lot, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The arena where this ceremony was made, and the site, and it was an event. It was you could picture. We would try to picture in the book what it looked like. It was a chaotic and static event for everyone who took 2-3 days ceremony. That kind of happening or a spiritual. Very deeply influencing the people who involved in this, with hundreds of people attending it.
Absolutely.
I mean, for what it's worth, if I thought that 90 tortoises would get me a dinner date with a girl from work, I'd definitely ante up and get them. But somehow, I don't think it will.
I must tell you that once I made one of my films I edited in London. Then somebody told me about the restaurant. I don't know if it still exists. It's in the city. It's a very posh restaurant, only for lunchtime for businessmen. And they served turtle soup. And I went there with my wife, who she's a veterinarian and vegetarian. And till today, she mentioned to me that I ate this turtle soup. Shame on me.
Well, that leads quite handily into the next question, because as modern Homo sapiens, we're good at getting into bad habits like sugar or eating turtle soup. Is there any evidence of this wanting more than we need in the prehistoric world? Because it feels like more, it's a sort of a human nature thing.
I think even in the very first paragraph of the book, you know, there is a whole chapter about hand axes, the biggest enigma in prehistory. And we won't go into this and what is hand axes and why is it such an enigma. It's a beautiful subject and story, and people should know about hand axes.
It's purposely beautiful... left that one out of this interview so that they have to buy the book.
Yeah. it's really a beautiful tool that served us for more than a million years. And one of the significance about this tool that it was, there were too many of it, way too many. Even today, we go to a dig. Me and Ron, we went to a place a few weeks ago in the Upper Galilee. And there were one after the other. So there were hand axes, too many. So when you ask this question, this was the first thing that came to my mind, even though it's not sugar, it's not something we eat. So maybe this tendency of having too much of what we need is something that we suffered from our very, very early days.
I have to agree. Sadly, I have to agree. Well, we need to understand that we are a strange mutation. We are a mutation of very specific kind of monkeys that can do it very little. But we, with the mutation, we cannot do it very little. We need much of everything. And this is one of the things that characterized, unfortunately, human nature. And the feeling you get while studying the human past is that humans were cutting the branch they were sitting on again and again and again and again. They wanted too much. They used too much. They pushed the limit too far. And we paid the price for that with sugar and with other things until now. We are far from being normal. We are strange. And we are paying for this strangeness. And not only us. Earth is paying for the strangeness. Because unlike us, all other animals can just be. We need to find reason to live. We need to find reason to make impression. We need and need and need. All other animals, they do not need. They just live. Right. But we need, I'm afraid, is harmful.
I have sat literally 2 feet away from a group of female lions eating their dinner in the wild, in the dark, and they had their dinner. They weren't remotely interested in us. Unless we tried to take that dinner, then they might have been angry. But they literally looked at us. You're not going to take my dinner. You're not going to hurt my babies. I don't care about you. The end.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the way we were introduced to sugar and sweet things, and I just discussed it with my son, that he was telling me that his younger brother is eating way too much sweets and he is addicted to sweets and what will. And we can really know in excavation and digging, we can tell when it started. So by examining tooth, when sweets became part of our life and destroyed our life. And now we do. So we're paying price now for mistakes that we made a long time ago. And although our book is we try to finish our book in a very, well, not a very, but in an optimistic, because we praise the human spirit and we do believe that we can solve problems but still we show in every chapter and along the way and in this journey, we stop and show the moments or long moments where we made mistakes. But the most important the most definite one is the agriculture revolution. But There are many others. So eating sweet stuff is one of them.
But again, as you said, Eyal, we must remain optimistic because we can see that along the very long human journey, humans made mistakes, but they are smart enough to correct the mistakes, to find solutions, to survive and thrive. So there is hope. People should realize that we are looking for too much. We make mistakes, but we have the capability of correcting the mistakes and doing it right. It's up to us.
It's very difficult. Usually I would agree with you, but you know, nowadays where the situation that where we live and what we go through, what we went through a few months ago, it becomes very, very difficult for me, a very optimistic person, to remain optimistic. But I'll take your word.
Well, I truly believe and follow
us Israelis.
No, and follow my studies of the human past. I truly think and feel that people are good in nature, and this can be extracted from them. Now we live in a world which is full of manipulation and extractions and so on, but I believe that people are good in nature. People found way to live one along the other for many, many years. This could be achieved. It's a matter of consciousness, of willingness. It is deep inside us, the good things.
Last time we spoke on the telephone, you didn't sound so optimistic, but okay.
He's having a good day. Probably my brain is more with you, Eyal, but I'm hoping Ran is going to prove us both wrong in the long term. Guys, thank you so much. This has been such a good interview. I cannot recommend this book highly enough. It's called They Were Here Before Us. It's out now. Do go and buy yourself a copy from an independent bookseller. Don't give any more money to Jeff Bezos. He'll only spend it on rocket fuel. Guys, this has been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Alex. It was a pleasure.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.